Good Sunday morning and welcome to another edition of the Gaelic Hour here on Chain 97.9 FM with Austin Cummerton. And wasn't it so wonderful to feel the heat over the weekend? I hope you managed to get out there and enjoy the blue skies. In today's programme, we're going to present to you the second in a presidential lecture series that was first broadcast on RTE back in January. And this is the second in the series with Dr. Louise Richardson, and she was born in County Waterford. And she is a political scientist and the principal and vice chancellor of the University of St. Andrews. She was formerly employed at Harvard University, where she served as executive dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies. We also have a competition running at the moment on the web, and that is for a pair of tickets for Celtic Thunder, and Celtic Thunder will be at Scotiabank Place on April 16th. You need to go onto the website to get access for that competition, and that is at www.thegaelicgar.ca. There is a skill testing question, but if you look in the links on the page, you might find a link to where you need to find your answers. And I met with Celtic Thunder earlier this week, and we'll be sharing that interview before the performance in April. This program is brought to you by the generous contributions that we receive from the Irish Village Group of Companies and also from the Monterey Inn Resort. Without their help, this program would not be on the air, and we are indeed very grateful. And the programs are also available on the website, and that is the magazine show which we put out on Sunday mornings. And we have archives going back to 2005. And we have a music program on Monday evenings, and Mary will be presenting the music program tomorrow evening. But I do want to fill you in on some of the events that are coming up here in the city, and there are some ongoing events. And of course, on Mondays, there is a session at, well, the McGinty's, I think it's in most of the time now, and this is with Cultus Cultoriern, and it's an impromptu session. You can head in there and enjoy the music. And of course, every Sunday morning, later on this morning, the Ottawa Gaels youth training goes on at the Oz Dome. Tuesdays, mornings 11 to 2, you have the Irish Society Seniors Drop-In, and that's at St. Margaret Mary's Church at Sunnyside and Fairburn. And they're getting over 50 people attending that now, so it's certainly become very, very popular. And coming up this weekend, there is an Irish Language Weekend at Kingston, Ontario. If you need information of that, drop me an email, austin@thegaelicgar.ca. And of course, on Friday nights, the Ottawa Gaels have their indoor Gaelic football going on. Saturday, there is a free lecture series presented by the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa. That's at Library and Archives Canada, 395 Wellington Street. And I see that there's a Ceilidh on Saturday night also, and that is down at the National Irish Canadian Cultural Centre in St. Bridget's at 314 St. Patrick Street. That looks like it starts at around 8 p.m. Then mark your calendars, because on the 9th of April, Tara Players open with the Ballymore Reel. And we will be talking to some of the people involved in that next Sunday morning. We're going to move right along and join the presidential lecture series with Joe Duffy of RTE and President Harry McAleese.
Gee, Eva Cardigal there, you're so welcome to Arras and Uachtaráin for this presidential lecture series. Good to see you all here, and good to have those who are listening to us with us too. This series is firmly located in the civic space, where we work together as friends and neighbours to build up our communities, to build up our country. Recent years, we know, have brought massive changes, with a big uplift in our standard of living, the miracle of peace also. We've seen a century and a half of outward migration from Ireland replaced by migration into Ireland, and we've seen the very rapid emergence of a dynamic and multicultural society. Now, of course, in common with so many other countries, we face much more testing economic times. Times that also raise a lot of questions about our values and about our vision for the future. As a people, our coping skills are legendary, and so this seems like a very good moment to reflect on the kind of Ireland that we want to build with those skills. What will its nature be? What will its values, its spirit? What kind of spirit will we infuse the future with? And these are questions for that civic space. They're questions that we're discussing in this series with the help of RTE, our speakers, our audience of young people here at Arras, and with your help also. One of the greatest strengths we have here is our community life, where strangers become neighbours, where people look out for one another, care for one another. Community does not happen by coincidence. It has to be built. And it flourishes where there's good leadership, where there's unselfish leadership. Today we're going to hear from Dr. Louise Richardson on the theme of Ireland's role in the world. Louise's own life and her very distinguished academic career has prepared her very well to take us through this theme. Several decades ago, Ireland made a fundamental decision that our place was out there in the world rather than turned in on ourselves. And we've managed to carve a fairly unique place for ourselves in the world today. And I know that I look forward with huge interest to hearing what Louise has to say about that role and about our possibilities. Please enjoy it. Gurumila Mahagith.
Thank you, President McAleese. Our guest speaker today was born in Waterford, studied history in Trinity College in Dublin before moving to the United States to study political science at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. There followed a distinguished career at Harvard University, where she specialized in international security. She has written extensively on the subject of terrorist movements in international relations and went to become executive dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. She has just been appointed principal and vice chancellor of the University of St Andrews in Scotland and is very well placed to speak today on the subject Ireland's role in the world. Would you please welcome Professor Louise Richardson.
Thank you, President McAleese. Thank you, Joe. I feel enormously privileged to be here today to participate in this innovative and important lecture series that has been given this opportunity to express my views on Ireland's place in the world. For a long time, Ireland was my world. I grew up as the second of seven children in Tramore, County Waterford, in a house that had been in our family for several generations. For as long as I can remember, even though I grew up in a small town, I was acutely conscious of a wider world. This was in part because I had an uncle who was a priest in the missions, but mainly because of a tradition in our school of saving our pennies and bringing them in on Fridays for what we called the black babies. I cringe now to use this term, because of the sense of paternalism and implied superiority that it suggests. But yet I know that it imbued in me an awareness of a wider world, an awareness that my position in this world, relative to a great many others outside the little world in which we lived, was a very privileged one, and a sense of responsibility to those others because of our shared humanity. So I took from this religious practice a quite secular message about what Stanley Hoffman has called duties beyond borders. I studied history in Trinity College, and one day as a student I came across a notice in the Irish Times, an announcement about something called Rotary Fellowships. So I decided to apply, thinking it would be a good experience for me, a good opportunity for me, a girl from the country, to compete against my smoother and more polished urban contemporaries. Nobody was more surprised than I was when I actually won the fellowship. It allowed me to spend a year in any university in the world, studying any subject I wanted. I chose the most exotic place I could think of, which was California. This experience changed my life, and I determined to return to America for further study. I subsequently left Ireland for graduate school. I actually left the day of my last exam in Trinity College, which was the same day as the Pope came to visit Ireland. There weren't too many people leaving Ireland that day, and I have not lived here since. My academic work, as you heard, has actually been focused on international relations and political violence, and my preoccupation with both derived directly from my Irish roots. My interest in international relations was ignited by the nuns and those pennies we saved, but it was sustained by a desire to break away from the narrow nationalism that I had encountered here, in which I saw doing so much harm. On the other hand, my interest in political violence, and especially in those who perpetrate it, was driven by a sense that academics who study terrorism, in particular, didn't understand the forces that drive people to violence to effect political change. The literature on terrorism has depicted terrorists as one-dimensional bad guys and psychopaths. My reading of Irish history, and indeed of my own times in Northern Ireland, suggests that it is much more complex than that. And I have been completely fascinated by how people who are responsible parents, students, teachers on the one hand, and can at the same time carry out brutal acts of violence, by the ways that they can justify these actions both to themselves and to others. So while I've spent my adult life outside Ireland, and I haven't actually participated in the Irish emigrant community, for me, my community has always been the university, yet the perspective that I've brought to all of my academic work has been profoundly influenced by my Irish upbringing. In leaving Ireland, I became part of the vast Irish diaspora, part of the estimated 70 million people of Irish descent living overseas. The historical Irish tradition of involvement overseas is extraordinary for a country of this size. From the ancient travelling saints and scholars dispensing Christianity and knowledge around Europe, to the 800 Irish soldiers serving in UN peacekeeping missions in 12 different conflict zones today. And I hope we will never forget the 85 Irish soldiers who have given their lives while serving as peacekeepers. I cannot think of another country of this size that can lay claim to such an international reach. And just a few weeks ago, I was in Chile, and I was driving down the O'Connell Street of San Diego, the main street, which is named after Bernardo O'Higgins. General O'Higgins, whose father was from County Sligo, was the hero of the Chilean War of Independence and was the first leader of independent Chile. Now, historically, people left Ireland for a variety of reasons, most because of poverty, some like me because of ambition, many others to practice and spread Christianity. Collectively, they not only generated an extraordinary number of Irish overseas, but perhaps more important than the raw numbers, they have acquired a reputation as hardworking, highly educated, caring, and fun-loving. More striking than the numbers of Irish overseas, I think, is their popularity. My eldest daughter recently had to write a college essay. This is a rite of passage for American teenagers, an essay that accompanies their university applications. And she chose to write about a frequent experience she had as a high school student in France. When asked her nationality, she would either answer American or Irish. And she wrote her essay about the different reactions these responses would elicit. An answer of Irish was invariably a prelude to a friendship. If she claimed to be American, the conversation ended. While the contrast no doubt says something about the unpopularity of recent American foreign policy, I think it also says a lot about the popularity of the Irish overseas. I think this popularity is partly due to the values the Irish immigrants brought with them, partly due to the contributions they made, and partly due to the fact that, unlike other countries with a global reach, we were the colonized rather than the colonizers, and hence not an object of resentment overseas. I think that this near-universal goodwill towards Ireland is a unique and powerful basis on which to build a place for Ireland in the world going forward. This goodwill has been acquired because of the hard work and enormous contributions made by the generations that have gone before us. But if we want to sustain this feeling, every generation will have to contribute. We cannot casually assume that we will always be liked or admired overseas. Demographic changes in countries to which we have historically been closest mean that there will be less affinity for Europe as other parts of the world become more heavily represented in their populations. This is especially true in the US, where the Irish American lobby is far from being the force it once was, and where more recent immigrants are drawing attention elsewhere. We should not take for granted that others will feel as warmly towards us as past generations have. Reputations generally tend to last longer than the conditions that caused them in the first place, and once lost, take a very long time to regain. I think we're going to have to work hard to maintain our reputation. And I always remember years ago when I was about 12 or so, Bernadette Devlin, as she then was, came to Waterford to give a speech. I went along with a cousin to hear her. And when she finished, my cousin said, "It's easy for poor people to be socialists. They've nothing to lose. It's much harder if you're rich." She had a point, and that has stuck with me ever since. And I think in a similar vein, it is much easier to have a virtuous foreign policy if you're a small country. It's very easy for us, for example, to decry nuclear weapons. We're never going to be in a position to acquire them. It's very easy for us to criticize foreign interventions. We're never going to be in a position to launch one. We're very proud of our tradition of neutrality. And yet I think if we were honest, we would have to admit that others see us as free riders. Our security is provided by NATO, in which we do not participate. Where we do win admiration overseas is when we engage in principled policies that cost us. Our environmental policy, abolishing plastic bags, for example, is constantly invoked and universally admired. Our commitment to peacekeeping missions and development assistance is admired because they demonstrate that we are willing to put actions behind our words. When I step back for a moment and look at the world since the end of the Second World War, nothing is more striking than the transformation of Europe. Today it is simply inconceivable to any of us that France, Italy, or Germany would engage with warfare with one another, and yet they did so for centuries. The reason for this extraordinary metamorphosis is the integration of the European economies through the common market and its successor institutions. Similarly, when one steps back and looks at the years since the end of the Cold War, I believe that nothing has contributed more to global peace and security than the enlargement of the European Union. This enlargement has been difficult, it has been costly, but it has had a profound and deeply positive impact on the peaceful political development of the newly emergent democracies in Europe. My personal view is that it would be utterly unworthy of the international role that Ireland has played for centuries if Ireland were to become a break on this process. However we might rationalise our position, I believe it would be seen overseas as a selfish one, in which we have, having acquired wealth for ourselves through our involvement in the European Union, we are shutting the door behind us. Given the goodwill that we enjoy in the rest of the world, the rest of the world has revelled in our successes. The entire world has been delighted by the peaceful resolution of the Northern Ireland conflict. When we look to the future, I hope that a role we will seek for ourselves is to be an advocate for peaceful means of resolving disputes. The patience, the dedication and the hard work of a large number of people were responsible for the Good Friday and St. Andrew's agreements. I believe that we should do our utmost to derive the lessons we have learned to help others resolve their ethnic disputes. But alongside this practical advice on conflict resolution, we should also keep our eyes on the broader picture. Disputes between legitimate competing nationalisms, be they in Kashmir, in Palestine or in Sri Lanka, become the swamps in which extremists breed. We should use the moral authority accorded us by the successful resolution of our own conflict to advocate in international forums for a concerted effort by disinterested external parties to help resolve these disputes. We are in a unique position to argue that underlying political causes of violence must be addressed and that extremists can in fact be persuaded to rely on peaceful means of effecting political change. Given our experience in this realm, I think others would be prepared to listen to us, and we could become a forceful advocate for peaceful change. The entire world, I think, is also delighted in Ireland's economic success. Poorer countries look to us as a model to which they can aspire. Wealthy countries, in which our immigrants and their descendants often serve in senior positions, have cheered the Celtic Tiger. Foreign Policy magazine has ranked ours the most globalised economy in the world. In 2004, The Economist magazine ranked us the best place to live in the world due to our successful combination of what they called the most desirable elements of the new, such as low unemployment and political liberties, with the preservation of certain cosy elements of the old, such as stable families and community life. This year, the Lonely Planet Blue List ranks Ireland as the friendliest place on the earth. Is it any wonder we have so many immigrants? The test for us will come now that the boom has ended. It is easier to be generous to immigrants when the economy is booming. Having provided the immigrants to so many other countries for so many years, we are uniquely placed to understand the difficulties of integration, as well as the extraordinary contributions immigrants make by strengthening the economy, enriching the culture, and broadening the perspectives of the societies into which they move. I hope that another role we choose for ourselves in the world is to serve as a model not just of economic advance, but also of successful integration of immigrants in good times as well as in bad. The Celtic Tiger taking a breather in the Celtic chalk, as it were. Again, given our past, we are uniquely positioned to be a powerful force for good in this realm. To have a place in the world in the future worthy of Ireland's historic place, we also need to continue our commitment to aid for developing countries. Ireland does relatively well in this area. We are ranked fifth overall, behind the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, by the Independent Centre for Global Development. Much of this contribution is private. In fact, we rank first at the top of the 22 richest countries in the world for private charitable giving for development as a share of the GDP, gross domestic product. This is an achievement of which we can all be proud, and I think speaks to the traditions inculcated by religious charities in the past. In terms of our net aid, as a share of the economy, 0.55%, we rank fifth. But as important as the amount of aid is the kind of aid. Unlike many other countries, we tend to give our aid without strings attached. And on this score, we are also ranked first in the world. We also rank first of the 22 richest countries in the number of immigrants from developing countries as a share of our population. We do much less well in trade and investment in poor countries, where we rank near the bottom. Strangely, we also rank 22nd, last out of 22, in the share of students from developing countries in Ireland. This seems to me to be quite a shame. the success of so many Irish emigrants, and I count myself amongst them, can be attributed to the excellent education we received in Ireland. One of the reasons so many foreign investors have come to Ireland is because of the highly educated workforce here. My own graduate education in the US was entirely funded by generous institutions which chose to invest in me, a foreigner. There are a great many other Irish people like me who've been recipients of similar generosity. I hope that we will see it as our role to invest in the future leaders of the developing world, to equip them with the skills necessary to advance their own economies. Irish universities have recently scored exceptionally well in the international rankings of universities. Trinity ranked in the top 50, UCD and UCC leapfrogged over 60 to 70 other universities. Rather than waiting for whoever applies to our universities, we can make a bigger contribution overseas by going out and recruiting promising young people in developing countries to come to Ireland for an education, as so many of us have benefited from foreign educations in the past. A place in the world in the future that is worthy of our past and consistent with our wealth is also a place that uses its wealth creatively, not just as a breathless cycle of acquisitive consumption, but of thoughtful and considered development. Ireland can be an example of a country that does not lose sight of what is important in a world in which rapidly developing economies are destroying communities in favour of economic advancement, much as Georgian Dublin was destroyed. Now, our record on this has not been so good. I was a student during the days of the Wood Quay demonstrations. But this is not a matter of letting the past impede progress. Rather, it is a case of bringing the best of the past with us to inform and enrich our future. We should aspire to remain at the top of the economists' list for best places to live because of our ability to advance economically without compromising our fundamental values. The final point I would make about Ireland's place in the world is again consistent with our past, and that is the value we have placed in the arts. Irish literature and music have permeated the world and won international renown for centuries. The impact of Irish music and film and literature is again out of all proportion to our size. The recent cultural rejuvenation is both an end in itself, but it's also consistent with our desire to do more, to be a force for good in the world. The powerful ethical exhortations to do good, which are subdued but in the writings of Seamus Heaney, but quite unrestrained in the music of Bono, of U2, of Bob Geldof, these have an extraordinary global reach. They are introducing new generations to the concept of global citizenship. So let me conclude by saying that we will never have a big place in the world, but we can have an important and honourable one, a place that is consistent with our past and of which future generations can be proud. We have a number of significant assets in achieving the role we desire. We speak a global language. We are wealthy. We have tens of millions of Irish descent around the world who identify with us. We have international goodwill. We have experience with successful conflict resolution, and we have a history which enables us to empathise with the victims of oppression and those seeking to effect political change. These are a unique set of advantages that would greatly facilitate our creation of a place in the world for ourselves in which we are seen as aggressive and entrepreneurial peacemakers. A country that uses its voice in international organisations to push for peaceful conflict resolution of existing disputes while addressing underlying political grievances likely to generate future conflicts. A country that is willing to act as well as to speak on behalf of the weak and the powerless. A country that generously contributes its soldiers to peacekeeping missions. A country that is a model for others in how to integrate successfully new immigrants. A country that is a model for others in how to accumulate wealth without losing sight of important community values, a country that supports its arts and cultural institutions, a country that invites promising young people from developing countries to participate in our educational institutions, a country that is an advocate for increased development assistance with no strings attached, a country that continues to enjoy international goodwill and that wins global admiration for its commitment to make the world a better place. This, I believe, is a place well within our reach, consistent with our past, and a place of which we would all be proud. Thank you.
You are listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cummerton. We're presenting to you the second in a series of lectures that was first broadcast on RTE in a presidential lecture series. And today's speaker is Dr. Louise Richardson. Do come back and join us after these messages. And don't forget, if you go on the website, there is an opportunity to win a pair of tickets for Celtic Thunder at the Scotiabank Place on 16th of April. And that, of course, is www.thegaelichour.ca.
You're listening to Ireland of Tomorrow, a presidential lecture series hosted here at Áras an Uachtaráin by Mary McAleese, President of Ireland. We have an audience drawn from all parts of the island of Ireland here today, and they have a few questions and points they wish to make.
Thanks very much. That was a very interesting presentation. I wanted to ask you a question. I've come here today from the Irish Centre for Human Rights. So the question relates to human rights, in which I think Ireland has always punched a little bit above its weight. Our constitution was a model for other constitutions, and former President Mary Robinson was the UN High Commissioner. I wanted to talk to you specifically about the interface between human rights and terrorism, because I know that there's quite a link there in terms of the causes of terrorism and also the state responses to it. Do you think Ireland could play a bigger role, given our previous experiences of it, both in terms of the successes and failures in our responses to terrorism, and also having been a kind of a suspect group ourselves? Do you think that there's more that we could do as a standard setter in that area?
Thank you, Niamh. Yes, I think this is a hugely important question. In too many instances, there seems to be people perceive a conflict between liberty and security. And I think it's a mistake to see this conflict. I think our best defense against terrorism is precisely to reiterate our commitment to human rights. And that I think one of the lessons of our own experience in Northern Ireland, it is a lesson other governments have experienced, is that when in an effort to defend our security, governments cease to pay attention to human rights, they usually end up generating more recruits for the terrorists. They tend to create more terrorists by abrogating the human rights of the suspect populations.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Richardson. My question is, in the recent US presidential election, there was some talk, some of the candidates did mention that they would refuse to negotiate with terrorists. What are your views on this, given that in our own country we probably wouldn't have peace if there hadn't been communication between the two sides? And also, is Ireland a good model for other countries trying to resolve their own conflict?
Thanks, Emma. On the last piece first, I think, yes, Ireland is a good model. I think a lot of American presidential candidates say something in campaigns that they probably regret, but I think it's very unwise to assert that one should never negotiate with terrorists. But I think if one looks at the history of counterterrorism, one finds that almost all governments declare that they will not negotiate with terrorists, and almost all governments do. Now, part of the problem, of course, is that when people hear negotiate with terrorists, they necessarily think one is making concessions and therefore one is legitimizing terrorism. And that's an understandable position. I understand that what drives somebody to take the position that they do not want to reward bad behavior. On the other hand, I think if one looks at the history of counterterrorism, one finds that it's actually one should engage with terrorists. I would argue that President Obama should engage, not personally, but his emissaries should. And in fact, I think we have found much of the recent security success in Iraq can be attributed to behind the scenes of engagement between the US military and the militias on the ground.
President McAleese, before Christmas you were in the USA.
We were in California, and California is always a very optimistic place. One of the things that struck me was just how important leadership is and how many people are looking forward to the new leadership of President Barack Obama. Not just because he is a fresh face, not just because he is a fresh administration, but I think also because of the kind of things that he has been saying in terms of the changes that he has a vision to bring about. And I think that's what we were picking up, was just the optimism that is around his assumption of office. I wouldn't like to be responsible for the stuff that's going to be on his table. But it did strike me just how important really good, strong, moral, value-laden, human rights-driven leadership is at this moment, and how people are responding to it also.
Coming from the North, I've seen sort of the success of the peace process. Do you think that model can be used in other areas, such as maybe Iraq or Afghanistan? And how do you think it'll change Ireland's standing in the international community?
Thank you, Aidan. Yes, I do think each conflict is different. I think one can generalise within types of conflict, but not across all different types. I think the conflict in Northern Ireland provides a lot of lessons for other ethnic conflicts, combating the ETA in Spain, for example, or the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, or indeed the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, the Kashmir disputes which involve competing nationalisms or ethnicities. I think the lessons of Northern Ireland are less pertinent when countering transformational groups that want, say, in the case of the Amishin Rikyo cult in Japan, to bring about the apocalypse, or indeed the elimination of capitalism, as was the case in the Red Army faction in Germany, Action Directe in France, Red Brigade in Italy, and so on. That will require a different response. A group that has deep ties in a community is virtually impossible for a government to defeat without engaging, to go back to Emma's question about engaging with the other. If a group, on the other hand, is isolated from the community, are much easier to counter. So the terrorist groups that have lasted the longest, the kind of groups that our lessons are most appropriate for, I think, are groups that involve conflicting nationalisms with groups seeking political goals that have close ties to the communities in which they operate.
I should say we have just appointed, well, in last year, Nuala O'Loan, Dame Nuala O'Loan was appointed a special envoy to Timor-Leste, to East Timor, on behalf of the Irish government, the first such appointment to pick up on that idea of Ireland being able to contribute something in targeted areas, as you say, that would be appropriate for Ireland and that our peace process would have something sensible to offer. So that work is ongoing now in East Timor. It's fascinating to hear you make that differentiation between the types of conflict that we might have something to bring to the debate on, and also to talk about the experience in our Northern peace process. I was very, very struck by what you were saying about people, if you like, stereotyping terrorists as people who should not be spoken to or could not be spoken to, because some of the people who were early initiators, very, very early initiators of the peace process in Northern Ireland were people who took the risk of speaking when everybody else was saying, no, don't talk. They weren't going to tell the terrorists that they agreed with what they said. They were actually going to them to say, do you see what you're doing and the objectives you have? The way you're going about it is all wrong. And they weren't arguing the morality of it, because clearly that was not an argument that the terrorists were particularly interested in. They were arguing the effectiveness of it. They were saying, have you ever thought about stopping and trying to construct an alternate way to getting to where you're going? Because here are all the adverse downstream consequences of what you're doing. Here are all the things that are getting in the way from your own actions. And I think that was a very important part of the peace process, wasn't it? When a small number of people decided to have that conversation and to force those who had adapted to and adopted terrorism as their sole way of solving their problems, said to them, actually, you know what? There are much more effective ways of doing what you're doing. Why don't you try them?
But there's also a very controversial way. It was vilified in a lot of the media. Anybody who did have any contact with the Provisional IRA were vilified.
They were for years and years and years, until it became obvious that what they were doing was engaged in actually a very powerful process of persuasion. And the evidence increasingly was in that their powers of persuasion were a lot more effective than the powers of persuasion of those who were involved in the terrorist groups, that they began to see that alternate strategies could deliver possibly not 100% of what they wanted, but eventually they were persuaded, I think, that 100% of nothing is still 100% of nothing, whereas 90% of something is a worthwhile destination.
On a completely different topic, over in my own experience, having lived overseas, we were continuously referred to as a country that economically was standing outstanding example of prosperity in the Celtic Tiger years. And in the current economic climate, how do you see us sort of continuing to be that shining example of economic development, or I suppose looking as a country of vision, how do you see Ireland doing that in the future?
Well, I think like the rest of the world, we're experiencing a dramatic financial crisis. In fact, I gather the economy here is expected to contract 4% next year. But I can think of no economy in the world which is doing well. So this is part of a global crisis. So the test for us, I think, is how we manage the slowdown, whether we manage it thoughtfully and carefully, or whether we lose the great advantages we made during this period of prosperity. Again, I would hope that we can become a model of a country that understands value more than cost, and that we continue to invest in what's important, like education in particular, even in the downtimes. Many governments are going to have to introduce stimulus packages, and I think it would be a real test to see where they choose to make those investments. I would hope that we would become a model for wise, long-term thinking in how we invest in order to stimulate the economy, and I would lobby for research and development, education and so on. But it really remains to be seen how this all plays out. We're in the same boat as most of the other economies at the moment.
Can I go back to a point you made earlier? I read it now, this situation that your daughter was in when she wrote this essay, when she was studying in France, and people say, where are you from? And she had a choice, Tremor or Tallahassee, I presume, and she got a different reaction. Mm-hmm. And the different reactions seem to be an American... She said she's from America, seemed to be so hurtful that people would almost immediately end the conversation. And yet if she said she was from Tremor, they were almost embracing. Now, does that tell us more about the French or the Irish or the American?
As I said, I have to say, I think it does say something about the recent unpopularity of American foreign policy. But I honestly think she would have had a very similar experience 10 years ago. And certainly I know from my own travels, I'm sure many people in the room who've traveled find that when one says one is Irish, people are interested. They are friendly. They see you as a friendly face. And this is an enormous resource that we can capitalize on. And I think it's for all the reasons I talked about, partly our history of being colonized as opposed to being a powerful country. Powerful countries are always resented. The Romans were, the British were, the Americans in many places are. Whereas we have this global reach without ever actually exercising power, so people haven't resented us for that. But also I think it speaks to the impact of the diaspora, the fact that there really are tens of millions of Irish people around the world who have acquired a well-earned reputation for being fun-loving, but also being caring, believing in community, and being real contributors to whatever society they're in. And so this is something I really do think we can capitalize on. But I do think it's likely to change as the demographics change, particularly in the US.
Louisa, picking that question up, you are someone who left Ireland and took your brain power and put it really, well, at the service of the international academic community, but fundamentally through the United States, where you've made a huge, huge contribution. And we have now in Ireland, in recent years, a very big immigrant population. Some of them will be mobile and they'll move on. Some of them will stay, and they'll stay through these tough times and they'll tough it out. And their kids are going to Irish schools, and the next generation will be Polish Irish, Hungarian Irish, you know, Latvian Irish. What would you say to them who want to make their lives here, who want to make the same kind of contribution that you got the chance to make in the United States? And how can we help create a community where their lives can soar without hitting barriers, the kind of barriers of stereotyping, the kind of barriers of resistance that would stop them from just really blossoming?
Well, here I think we can learn a lot from the US. I know the US has been unpopular in recent years, but really it is an extraordinarily open meritocracy. And the fact that I was a foreigner never at any instance inhibited me in any way, precluded me from applying for any fellowship. And that really is quite extraordinary, that one's wealth or one's poverty was completely irrelevant. It is a meritocracy. People are valued because of their contributions. And the US has been extraordinarily successful in integrating immigrants throughout history and indeed in recent years too. And so I think I would look to the US as a model there. We have to treat our immigrants the way we wished our immigrants in other countries were always treated. I think that's a lesson we should bear in mind. Are we treating these people the way we wished our grandparents who went to Boston after the famine, our great-grandparents, were treated? I think we should absolutely see immigration as a positive force for this country. This is not charity to another. We benefit from immigration. Our economy benefits, our culture benefits, our society benefits. I think our leaders have constantly to remind us that we're the beneficiaries of immigration. This isn't about charity. The society and the culture will benefit. And I think if we just kept the mantra that are we treating people as we wish we were treated, I think that would keep us on a good path.
Hi, my name is Don Miller, and I'm from University of Ulster Students' Union. I just want to bring back to a point about cultural heritage and about the whole idea that Ireland's become a lot more multicultural, and also with the recent kind of development of the economy and the whole idea of Ireland modernising itself. Do you think this has had an adverse effect on local culture and local Irish heritage? Has it in a way seen it being more diluted because it's been faded out?
Actually, I don't. I see culture not as something static. Culture is something that, whether we're talking about music, literature, film, is something that is constantly changing. And so far from undermining or diluting traditional Irish culture, I would see it as being reinforced and reinvigorated by the infusion of new ideas and new perspectives.
Taking on board what you said about education, our role, what can we make of our role in education around the world, human rights around the world, tradition, that point just made there. And the question almost has changed within the last 12 months. It's not the broader visionary question, what can we make of our role, of our difference in education, of our difference in how people regard us. It is now what can we make from it? Do we have a role economically in trying to attract students to Ireland in terms of education, in trying to attract skilled immigrants to Ireland in terms of that difference? Is there an economic aspect to all those visionary things which we were so broad about and you've articulated so well? Is there an economic aspect of it? Because that's what a lot of people in Ireland today are rightly so worried about.
I can absolutely empathise, understand anybody's concern about the immediate financial crisis. But I would argue that this is precisely a time when we again step back and think of the bigger picture and don't just think of next week, but think broadly. We are, let's face it, we're all facing an economic crisis. It is not hyperbole to describe this as a crisis. And I think if one looks at how, again, historically, at how crises are best navigated, it's by stepping back and turning them into opportunities, asking ourselves what's important. You know, in recent years, there was a considerable concern in this country that we were losing sight of what was important in the race to accumulate more things, more stuff, more consumption. And I think now that we've realized that having acquired a second or third or bigger car, it doesn't actually bring happiness. And now that we may have to sell the second or third car, it's not actually going to make us unhappy. What makes us happy are the fundamentals. This means going back to the point President McAleese opened with, the enormous importance of community. And again, so we think about what will make our community strong in 2016 or in 2026. I think what will make it strong then is investing now in integration of immigrants, in education, in research and development, in the longer term, and not simply become too wrapped up in the immediate crisis. Because grave as this crisis is, we should never forget that, relatively speaking, we are still spectacularly wealthy. We compare ourselves to other parts of the world or even to an Ireland of the past. We are spectacularly wealthy, and we shouldn't forget that.
President McAleese, is there anything that can dilute the economic pain we're going to face this coming year?
Oh, is there a magic wand and have we got it here in the Aras? I don't think so. I think if there was something that could dilute that pain, every government in the world is looking for that, isn't it? But I think that to pick up Louise's last point, one of the things that we have here is the strength of community. And it does look very much as we go forward and try and navigate a path through these difficult and very testing times. It was, Louise said it, you know, it was easy to be generous and it was easy to be all sorts of things when we didn't have money worries and when we were full of the self-confidence of these staggering growth rates that were the familiar language of the Celtic tiger. Now we're really put to the pin of our collar. We're tested. We're challenged. We have the best problem-solving generation we've ever had. Their analytical skills are extraordinary. They are the people, this is the generation that helped solve the peace process. This is the generation that's helped solve the poverty problem, helped bring an end to immigration, helped generate the wealth, created the idea of the 12.5% corporation tax, the social partnership model. This is the generation that has a lot of achievement already pocketed, but now it has to take that achievement, distill it and head into tough times. And I don't think there's a magic wand exactly, but I just do think that collective brain power and operating not out of a sense of rampant individualism, which really got us into a lot of these difficulties, but out of a much stronger sense of connectedness to community and to ask ourselves, what are we really about here? I think that's the space that is likely to present us with the arguments. I mean, to take something very simple. If we begin, as we did, to see our homes as places where we grow equity instead of growing family and kids, then we've got a big disconnect. We've got a big disconnect from what we're doing is doing humanly, and we're going to pay a price for that, and we probably are paying a price for that. But if we reconnect to what we're about, I think we begin to guide ourselves much better. I think if we reconnect to what's important, we'll find our way out of this, and we'll certainly find our way out of it together. I mean, I'm old enough to remember other recessions, possibly not as bad as this. They felt bad at the time. I mean, I remember a time when it was 20% interest rates and 20% unemployment and nobody could sell a house. And I tell my kids this and they look at me and they say, you know, they think that I belong to some other planet. So my generation has been through ups and downs before. And the one thing we do know is that after the down does come the upswing. But this time, when we do get to the ups, what do we want to bring into that? Do we want to just have the same old problems carried forth? Or do we want to have a freshness, a real almost sanitation, a ridding ourselves, a purging of bad practices, bad attitudes that help to fuel where we're at now, and a kind of a healthier time ahead? When we talk about climate change, maybe we want to think also about the internal climate inside the human spirit.
I would now like to invite President McAleese to close today's programme.
Well, it's certainly been it's been a privilege to listen to that really very fascinating discussion, and I want to thank Dr. Louise Richardson for sharing so deeply with us her perceptions, her wisdom, and her clear passion for these issues, and thankfully her great passion and love for her country. She paints such a rich canvas of possibility in terms of the contribution Ireland can make to the world over the coming time, how powerful the benefits can be for us, how powerful the benefits can be for our world. And we also, of course, we had a great contribution from our audience today here at the ARIS. So a very big thank you to each of those of you who took part and participated so fully in this afternoon.
A very big thank you to RTE and to Joe. You can always count on Joe to get a discussion going, and he did that with his usual genius, a very special genius and empathy. And as with the other programmes in the series, of course, the really big hope is that wherever the listeners are, wherever you're at in your life, that you'll keep this discussion going among friends, among family, among community, so that we can begin to see in Ireland with some degree of clarity what it is we want to build for ourselves and for our children, and maybe begin to get some ideas as to how exactly we're going to do that individually and together. Go raibh míle maith agaibh go léir.
You've been listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton, and this morning you heard the second in a series of three of a presidential lecture series that was first broadcast on RTE and recorded at Orasan Uachtaráin with President Mary McAleese. This programme is brought to you in part by the generous contribution that we receive from the Irish Village Group of Companies and also from the Monterey Inn Resort. Without their help, we would not be here on the air. There are tickets available to be won if you go on the website thegaelichhour.ca for Celtic Thunder, and Celtic Thunder will be at Scotiabank Place on April 16th. So head on to the website there and click on the link and fill out the form, and you may win a pair of tickets. And also, this program will be available on the internet later in the week. If you'd like a dedication played on the music program, send me an email. We have a playlist up there that gives the music that is here on the show. And Mary will be with you here tomorrow night, giving you her flavour of music. This is Austin Camerton saying, Slán go fóill.